Hello, everybody, and welcome to class 3 of Flow Genome Project's Flow Fundamentals, Practices and Principles of Peak Performance. I'm Jamie Wheel, and with me is Stephen Kotler. And today we're going to be leading you guys through an exciting bunch of new content, building on where we started and taking us another lap forward into a deeper dive into how to explore flow and specifically how to work with key flow triggers. So what the day looks like is we're going to start with a bit of an overview and review. So we've already covered two classes. Want to make sure everybody's got the key points from those first two classes so that we can kind of secure them and then move forward, adding new insights and technicalities. We are going to move forward, as I mentioned, into the first three triggers that come from the world of action sports in particular, but are translatable to all of us everywhere. We're then going to go into a deeper dive onto how those flow triggers map in our life, and very specifically, what can we do in this coming week to actually give ourselves challenging and fun assignments to experience them more. And then lastly, as usual, ending with our homework for the week where we actually get to put this stuff on the ground. So without further ado, let's go ahead and move forward and take a look at the basics of the first two classes that we've covered. So the first is just the simple definition, right? Flow is an optimal state of feeling and of being and doing, as it matters, right? Where we feel our best. So there's a sense of euphoria, there's a sense of calm, whatever it is, it's uniformly a positive association. And performance tends to click at levels several above our conventional waking state. You can think of this another kind of slightly more practical way to think of a working definition of flow is it's extreme situational awareness on the one hand, meaning I am picking up more information from my environment than I would typically do, and hyper ergonomics, meaning kind of like Bruce Lee's one-inch punch, right? How does a little guy like that, 5'6", 130 pounds, soaking wet, manage to send, you know, seasoned martial artists flying across the room? Well, he does it via exceptionally efficient alignment of body, muscles, ligaments, tendons, bone, as well as mind focus. So if we think of flow as, you know, extreme situational awareness and hyper ergonomics, that's a great functioning way for us to think about it and then be able to also tweak and adapt our life to have more of it. Key idea, if you guys remember that nice blue flow cycle, is that it's exactly that. It's a four-stage cycle, not a light switch. And a flow state is something that by its very definition comes and goes and is wed to struggle, relaxation or release, and recovery. And that if we want more flow, paradoxically, we have to get comfortable with more struggle as well as more focused and intentional relaxation and recovery. Just covered that one, which is, again, if we want it, the best places to play with it are how to, when I get into struggle, learn to pivot versus continue to struggle head on, and how do I make the most of consolidating my gains in my recovery stage. And we've been focusing just on the simplest part of that, which is deep, restful delta wave sleep, where a lot of integration can happen. The simplest thing here is, if and as, and this goes back to our assignment for last week, the week just leading into today, which was let's just notice and rate how our flow experiences are day to day on a 1 to 5 scale. And what we're trying to do there is make sure that by paying attention to things, we will actually see them more often. And if anybody's ever had the experience of buying a new car and then suddenly the road seems overrun with exactly that model where a month before you never noticed it, you've just experienced the very same thing we've been harnessing in noting and logging and rank and rating our own flow experiences. To go back to the core component of our content from class 2 was the idea of states and stages. So we said, hey, we're talking about flow states. That's why everyone has joined this training, and that's what we as an organization do. But they don't exist in a vacuum, and they exist firmly nested in a developmental context, which is what stage of development am I at? And fundamentally, if we use flow to both get a sense of our kind of turbocharged self, right? I'm feeling my best and I'm performing at my best. We can sort of, we then have a felt sense, or what is technically known as a somatic trigger. So we can literally, in our bodies, we have a reference point, like riding training wheels on a bike, of what it looks and feels like for me to act and be that way. And when we do that, we've also learned that flow massively accelerates the learning curve, so that by reaching up one floor, as it were, to experience a flow state, we can halve our learning cycle in moving up to increasing stages of developmental complexity. And all that means is upgrading our operating system. I can handle more perspectives efficiently and accurately. I can handle more information. And generally speaking, a host of other good characteristics and qualities come online as I make that upward climb. And flow is not the point. Flow is the fuel to help me do that. This is one that came up in some of our Flow Hacker Nation conversations, as well as we described and unpacked the flow cycle itself. How do we get through the struggle phase? And just to take some time to kind of shine a light on this one, because if you leave this entire six-week program with nothing else other than this, I would say it's absolutely worth its weight, which is when we get into the struggle phase, we described how it's kind of it's almost a bipolar experience, right? My executive function, the smartest guy in the room, specifically in the front of my brain, is used to trying to solve problems head on with rational thinking and linear logic. When I get stuck there, I get kicked back into a much more primitive part of my brain, my amygdala, and I toggle back and forth almost to the point of fibrillation. Am I going to fix it with a full frontal assault from my smart, rational, linear brain, or am I going to collapse into fight and flight? And the best way, obviously, fight and flight is the most primitive impulse in that struggle phase, and the best way to maintain and manage it and not get hijacked by those impulses is focusing on respiration. And that has a host, number one, obvious but worth saying, is that when we get stressed, one of the first things that happens, we tend to take short, contracted, shallow breathing. We basically, our lungs get pooled with carbon dioxide. We get very poor air exchange. And our brains are borderline hypoxic, meaning literally lacking oxygen, which, of course, triggers and reinforces a fight or flight state. So when we breathe, and we can breathe slowly, deeply, powerfully, right, we get closer to 100% air exchange, our oxygen saturation goes up, our brain and body can relax, and you know, happily, other good things cascade off that, namely cardiac coherence, our heart rate becomes slow, steady, rhythmic, and our brain waves are poised and better able to relax from a super agitated beta state into a more relaxed alpha and below. Okay, and then the other component is, what do we do with that prefrontal cortex, which is the me paying attention and critiquing the rest of me that's screwing up horribly and struggling? And one of the thoughts there, which is just the notion of, we can have one of two ways of looking at the world. One is a fixed mindset, meaning I am the sum total of my accomplishments, achievements, intelligence, talent. And the other is a growth mindset, which is I am experiencing the results of my practice, training, preparation. And those results are changeable based on how well I prepare and train for the next event. So if I'm getting into a struggle which is way beyond me, right? For instance, being on a ski slope, I can say either I suck, this is stupid, I hate this, and I want it to end, right? A very fixed mindset, like this is challenging me, it's humiliating me, and I just want to blow it up, be done with it. Or I could say, wow, this is a really hard ski slope. I am flailing, but I'm just going to try and get down it, and I'm going to try and focus on learning what I can while I'm here. So breath to avoid the fight or flight response, and a growth mindset, focusing and emphasizing my own training, my own practice, my own development, versus taking this as a blow to my ego, which can just leave me struggling harder. Okay, we're going to talk about this in quite a bit of detail today, which is fundamentally the role that embodiment plays in flow states. And said another and more simple way is that, you know, we are much more than just brains on sticks. We actually have complex and interdependent nervous systems, physiology, and when we pay attention to that whole package, right, we can typically get into flow states more effectively than if we were just, you know, butt in a seat, staring at a screen, and moving or engaging none of the rest of us. And the three simple ways we can do that, right, is by something super intense or overwhelming. That would be the, you know, the downhill mountain biker or the bungee jumper, right, or something along those lines. Or duration, right, I can do something like the sort of the loneliness of the long distance runner, right? I can go out on an ultra marathon. I can go out and ride my bike for hours. I can do something that fundamentally wears down that waking inner critic, just exhausts, just physically exhausts that part of ourselves, right? Or repetition. And repetition could be I'm at a potter's wheel. It could be I'm out going for, I'm gardening and I'm just kind of, you know, snapping, picking peas and snapping them, picking peas and snapping them. It could be knitting or crochet, right? Any sort of repetitive, almost hypnotic act that then, that similarly does an end run. So think about intensity, the full on, you oh shit, fight or flight kind of thing, which we hopefully get around. The duration, I'm just going to exhaust that executive function in myself, and then see what emerges after that, or repetition through just engaging my sort of sensory motor circuits. I'm going to just kind of do a bit of an end run around my normal waking critic. So hopefully that's a good recap and maybe even a couple of new thoughts or ideas on what is the terrain we've covered and how does it all fit together. Okay. So now we're going to go into our core content for today, which is just taking a look, and huge amounts of this have come from Stephen's work and his research in writing Rise of Superman, and that the whole thesis in that book, which is fundamentally that, you know, action adventure sports have progressed flow and flow hacking as far or further than almost any other population. And so before we jump into the details, Stephen is going to take an opportunity here and just take a look at what are flow triggers and specifically what are kind of these big three that action and adventure sports athletes have used to such good effect.
Thanks, Jamie. Hi, everybody. Really glad to be with you today. So to kind of break down flow, the first thing we need to know about getting more of it in our life is that, as Jamie pointed out, flow has triggers. There are about 12 of these in total. Three are environmental, meaning they're external to yourself. Three are internal, they're psychological. There is one creative trigger. And then there are six social triggers that bring on group flow. And we'll talk about everything except the environmental triggers next week. Before we drill down into the environmental triggers, the first thing you need to know is that flow is always a present tense experience, right? It can only take place in the now. So what all these triggers do is they are ways of driving attention into the now. They're essentially, put differently, these are the exact ways evolution shaped your brain to pay attention to the present moment. These are all the things that capture and hold our attention the most. So in the environmental triggers and the external triggers, there are three big categories. And I'm going to give you kind of the top-down level view of this, and then Jamie's going to drill down deeper in a moment. But at a high level, what you're looking at with these flow triggers, three categories: high consequence, rich environment, and deep embodiment. We'll start with high consequences. This is pretty straightforward, right? Flow follows focus, and consequences catch our attention. So when there's risk in the environment, we pay more attention to the environment. Action adventure sport athletes pull this trigger all the time because they're putting their body in harm's way in the mountains and the waves and whatever. It's a very easily accessible trigger to them. But there are a couple points that are really, really critical. First is it is totally dependent upon the individual. So the amount of risk that I need to get into a flow state is totally different from what somebody else needs. A big wave surfer like Laird Hamilton, he's got to paddle into a 50-foot wave to pull this trigger. But for a shy woman, she nearly has to raise her hand and speak up at a meeting to pull the same trigger. So very individual. The other thing that's more important here is that it's not just physical risk. In fact, you can substitute social risk, intellectual risk, creative risk. All these things work the same. Your brain can't actually tell the difference between social risk and physical danger. It processes them in the exact same structure. So you feel social fear and physical fear, same places, same parts of the brain are used in it. And you can kind of understand why this is if you think about evolution. Until about 250 years ago, if you got exiled, if you were banished, the tribe kicked you out, that was pretty much a death sentence. It was a capital punishment. So social phobias, right? I don't want to screw up and piss off my tribe, piss off my people and get kicked out, are processed in the same way that we process mortal consequences. So the brain can't tell the difference, which means you can hack this trigger, the physical consequences, if that's not your thing, by taking social, emotional, creative, and intellectual risks, which is really, really cool. Equally important with the high consequence trigger is the fact that what you're trying to get at underneath all of this is dopamine. Dopamine, whenever the brain takes a risk of any kind, we're given more dopamine. It's just the brain's way of, A, it reinforces that risk-taking is good. From kind of an evolutionary perspective, it's good when we go out and follow our curiosity. We might find new resources, new people to have sex with. Those are good things, right? So it's reinforced with dopamine, but the dopamine also ups our performance in the moment, and that's what we're trying to get at is the dopamine. So the next, by the way, organizationally, this tells you something really important about organizations and businesses, which is Silicon Valley companies that have a fail forward, fail faster motto. Facebook has a sign hanging in their main stairwell that says, move fast, break things. These kinds of companies are really well suited to take a lot of advantage of flow, right? If you don't have this kind of fail forward motto, you're not giving people enough space to take risks and you're not creating an organizational environment that's good for flow. So the next trigger is the rich environment. A rich environment is a fancy way of saying lots of novelty, complexity, and unpredictability in the environment. All three of these things, when we're confronted head on by too much information that we can't process, we have to process it, we'll switch from conscious processing to subconscious processing. Conscious processing, as we talked about, it's very, very slow, pretty inefficient, and it's got a very small RAM capability. Only hold a little bit of information. Conscious processing a lot faster. You want the brain to make this switch. And we've all had this experience, by the way, when we feel awe, right? We see geologic time. You stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon for the first time. You look up at the night sky and see billions of galaxies above you. And time seems to, you get sucked into that moment and it can stretch down. You start to feel awe. Awe is the front end of a flow state. It's the beginning of that feeling of time dilation. It's being sucked in by the moment. It's that complexity trigger, being overwhelmed by information and the meaning of information that it takes more of your brain to process it. So that's how that works. If you want to see, you know, how this works in action and adventure sports, obviously they're performing in living environments. So no two waves are the same. Alaskan snowpack morphs on a moment-by-moment basis. These are living systems. They change all the time. Packed with novelty, complexity, and unpredictability, action adventure sport athletes are encountering them all the time. But it's not obviously just action adventure sport athletes who can lean on this trigger. Steve Jobs, famously, because he wanted to increase the amount of flow and the amount of creativity at Pixar when he was designing the building, his problem was there wasn't enough novelty, complexity, and unpredictability. People weren't talking to one another. The marketers were staying over here. The engineers were staying over here. The animators were over there. Nobody was talking to each other. So he rebuilt Pixar, put a giant atrium in the center, and he put the meeting rooms, the cafeterias, the mailboxes, and most strategically, the only bathrooms in the building right next to this atrium. So everybody had to congregate there. It massively increased the amount of novelty, complexity, and unpredictability in the environment. The result was far more flow, far more creativity, and, you know, what became Pixar as the result. It was a brilliant move. The last of these triggers is what Jamie mentioned at the start, deep embodiment. Deep embodiment basically means we are made up of multiple sensory streams, right? We have inputs coming in all over the place. We have our five major senses. We have vestibular awareness, proprioception, vestibular awareness. It's balanced proprioception, it's body position, space. So when you're paying attention to all these information streams at once, so much information, it drives focus into the present and precipitates flow. Action adventure sport athletes are obviously very, very good. First of all, physical activity in general is good for pulling the deep embodiment trigger, but they're encountering multiple Gs, zero Gs, and polyaxial rotation or rotation around one's middle. We are gravity-bound creatures, right? We don't normally get to experience those sensations. So when you do, it's kind of like the environment shouting to you, hey, this is important, pay attention. That's exactly what happens. The interesting thing about deep embodiment is Montessori education, which is one of the highest flow environments on Earth outside of action adventure sports, and we know this because in the 90s, Csikszentmihalyi and Kevin Rathunde, who's a professor at the University of Utah, went looking for the highest flow environments they could find, and Montessori education is one they lit on. And one of the main reasons is Montessori education is often called embodied education. It means they emphasize learning through doing, not just learning through reading about it. So don't just read about the windmill, go out and build one. By doing that, by going out and building a windmill, you're engaging multiple sensory streams at once. You're paying more attention. It's driving attention into the now. It is precipitating flow. Action adventure sport athletes exist in an environment that is packed with these three triggers. It's actually on a whole why they have moved so far so fast is not just these three triggers. It's all 12 of the flow triggers. They've actually packed their lives. They've sort of built their lives around these triggers. That's what happened. That's what started this progression in action adventure sports. That's what gave them all this easy access to flow. But the larger point, and especially with these triggers, is it's not just the athletes, right? Anybody can do this at any scale in their lives. So I'm going to stop there and kick it over back to Jamie, and he'll drill down deeper and kind of reinforce some of what I said, and then I'll be back later to fill you in some more.
Perfect, Stephen. Thanks very much. And if you would just confirm for me that you guys are also now seeing the screen, that would be a great help. And what I'd like to do now is exactly that, is just go ahead and basically drill down into each of those three things, the rich environment, the deep embodiment, and the high consequence, and just kind of see some of the building blocks. And Stephen alluded to or spoke to many of them. But the goal here is we're going to end up with 9 categories, right? 3 for each of those 3 main topics. And as we do that, we want you to be thinking, huh, how does that show up in my life or not? Because the worksheet, the flow triggers worksheet, which is what we're working on today together, is going to be explicitly based on answering those questions and either building on successes you're already having, or potentially a little bit more, you know, edgy for some folks, will be adding in something new that you're not currently doing in your life. So in deep embodiment, in that realm of, you know, fundamentally not just being a brain on a stick, but using more of our whole self system. Right, there are 3 categories, and we're going to take the time to go into each, so you don't need to worry about getting it right now. But it's somatic cognition or embodied cognition, which just means that when I am using my whole body and brain, both work better. The next is intrinsic motivation. When I am doing things right that prompt and precipitate flow, it feels awesome, and I am compelled to come back to it. Versus I've got to get up and floss my teeth or work out on the orbital trainer, and it's driven by guilt or vanity or some other thing. So there's something really powerful about the driver of intrinsic motivation that shows up in a flow state. And the next one is sort of hedonic engineering, which is just a, you know, needlessly complicated word for the people, particularly big mountain athletes or just, you know, big mountain, big wave athletes, are generally quite good connoisseurs of a good party. And not just a good party, but shifting their states of consciousness beyond vanilla suburban rush hour down the middle, and as a result, they too have additional ways to get around that prefrontal cortex. So if we toggle over to our environment, where is this all taking place? Stephen alluded to it, radical novelty, right? Big nature, just being out in amazing, awe-inspiring places, and a simplified self. So for anybody that's gone camping for a weekend or a week and comes back to the car thinking, wow, this was all rather strange, these kind of accoutrements of civilization, you've experienced at least a little bit of that, or you know, done aid work in a foreign country, or any time you've traveled around the world and then come back, you realize, oh, wow, a lot of the trappings that I thought were me, are not so much that. That's costume, and I now understand that some of this can be stripped away. And lastly, the high consequence part, which often gets a lot of the media, gets a lot of the press. It's the notion of the adrenaline junkie, right? And certainly kind of Red Bull Media and GoPro have kind of built their entire empires on these. But the simplest is, in a realm of high consequence, you have instant feedback, so very tight and quick learning cycles. You have peak arousal, meaning I am alert, there is no question about it, I am here and I'm about to do something intense, and mortal stakes, which is, you know, we'll talk about it more in a moment, but is fundamentally the idea of if I'm in situations in which I might actually die or get severely injured, that is fundamentally a different human experience and an increasingly rare one, at least in the civilized, sanitized West. So this is the way we're looking at it, right? We've got our three core concepts inside the pyramid, and then each of them has additional three legs. And let's take them one at a time. And this is specific to extreme athletes, right? And not just sort of, you know, NFL, NBA kind of players, but we're talking about folks that are out there risking life and limb in wild and unpredictable environments. And that's really the first thing that we want to make sure you guys get, which is, as opposed to AstroTurf in a superdome with a closed ceiling where the ball bounces exactly the same way, my cleats are designed specifically for this fabric, and everything is hyper-predictable. Mountains, waves, oceans, rivers, right, are constantly changing and are never identical. Even the same surf break or the same mountain, depending on swell, wind direction, etc., or depending on snowpack and solar exposure, they're going to be and feel and perform completely differently. And what that does is it means I cannot phone it in, right? Unlike a gymnast where the vault is exactly 32 paces from where my starting point is every single time I do it, and it's at exactly 4 inches, you know, four feet, 10 inches high, and it's the same every single time, right? The fact that there's this variance forces these athletes to pay attention. And what happens when I'm forced to pay attention in an uncertain environment? And Robert Sapolsky at Stanford University has done a lot of the research on this, as well as some work at Emory. And the idea, even with rats, is that, you know, if a rat, you know, taps that, you know, sort of infamous cocaine button, right, in their little cell, and they get a shot or reward, and it spikes their dopamine levels. Let's call it a level set 100%. But if that very same rat goes to that very same lever and pushes it, and sometimes he gets a shot of cocaine and sometimes he doesn't, meaning it's uncertain. When he does actually hit pay dirt, when he actually does get the reward, his dopamine levels spike 400%. So four times, it's just the old Winnie the Pooh adage, right? It's the moment just before eating the honey that can be even more pleasurable than eating the honey itself. Anticipation, what is about to happen, and then salience, something relevant happened. Those are the secret hacks to major dopamine overload. So rather than getting bored, I'm fired up, I'm paying acute attention, and I am massively rewarded when I find that powder stash, when I find that smooth spot to drop in on the wave, when I thread the needle in this novel and unpredictable environment. Stephen mentioned the notion of awe, right? And what happens when we actually get to be in big nature. And by big nature, you know, you can take it as wilderness, you can take it as park areas, you can take it just looking out at the ocean or a big body of water. Some of us may even have that experience, if we're not too jaded, when we pop up above the clouds in a plane and are just covering ground from a perspective that normally we don't get to hold. But the simplest is we don't need to get fancy, and we don't need to wrap this one in neuroscience to explain it. But fundamentally, I mean, from ancient times until now, people have always gone into the wilds, gone beyond the pale or beyond the kind of fences of civilization and culture to connect in some way to some things bigger than or other than themselves. And one of the simplest things that happens out there, and you know, the Grand Canyon is a very vivid and easy example of this, which is, you know, as you see the layers of that canyon and the erosion, you know, 2,000 feet deep, you are literally looking back in time. As you're looking up at stars at night in the backcountry, which is, you know, no light pollution, much darker than normal, you know, you're seeing light that is potentially from extinct stars that are still shining down on you. Those kind of dislocations from, you know, my calendar invites popping up on my smartphone and me measuring and managing my life by 15-minute increments, right? To see things that have, you know, in the realms of that, you know, that great poem, I think it was Shelley, right? Ozymandias, right? Where it's almost like the old Planet of the Apes movie where Charlton Heston sort of sees the torch of the Statue of Liberty buried in the desert, right? And there's that sense, and in the poem Ozymandias, you know, it's this poem of this ancient statue of an incredibly badass king, supposedly, but, you know, now his statue is eroded in the sand, and then the tagline at the bottom is, you know, look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. Like I'm the G, right? But in fact, the point of the poem is, yeah, all things pass, right? All human scales of time and significance get dwarfed by the bigger kind of wheels of time. And so, being out in nature can be deeply humbling. Being standing on top of a mountain you climb to the top of, and looking backwards, forwards, 360 degrees, and seeing nothing but more snow-capped mountains. That's a fundamentally different experience than being in the shopping mall near Christmas and looking at who's wearing what shoes. And, you know, now we can add in the neuroscience, which is what Stephen alluded to, which is one of the experiences of being in complex, highly novel environments, meaning there's lots of moving parts and pieces and there's not a predictive pattern to it, is we get overwhelmed and we experience that complexity plus some form of aesthetic beauty, right, as awe. And experience dopamine and experience kind of a cognitive interrupt, which many of us can find, you know, both meaningful and or welcome. And the last one, you know, this is the kind of so what, what's my subjective experience on all this, is when we leave behind all the signs and signifiers and trappings of culture, there is an opportunity to feel a little bit more free and to be able to re-examine, right, that prefrontal cortex identity, who do I think I am, in some new and fresh ways. And one of the things of being in big natural environments will quickly do for you, and this is, I think, in part why there's all of those Survivor shows on TV. I mean, at both Survivor, the goofy reality contest, but also like the Bear Grylluses and the Naked and Alone, and, you know, I mean, there's that whole genre, right, of bunging people into primitive environments and seeing how they do, right? The first is, oh, shit, I could die out here. And when you're faced with that, it's no longer a question of preference. It's no longer a question of being entertained. You have to tap something that is in that fight or flight. And I have to get in touch with an animal self, right, that in our sort of smoothed over, anesthetized, you know, sidewalk and handrails and ADA and OSHA kind of worlds rarely have to get anywhere near. And the combination of those two things, if I can kind of, you know, get into a place where my cell phone doesn't work, where I'm not thinking about my Facebook updates, etc., and I just set aside for a moment my socially defined roles, and I'm pushed to then also connect with something deeper and more primal in myself, right, as it's just the will to live and a naked ape roaming this planet, well then at times, right, can be these moments of grace where we're like, oh, what's it all for? What's the point? And that's always been, whether that's the vision quest tradition or whether that's just a moment of specific calm and insight as you take off your climbing skins if you're a skier or a snowboarder and you get ready to go down a hill, or you're a surfer who's just out there bobbing in the ocean, and you know, you see the sunset and some dolphins come by. Whatever those moments are, we can't really kind of predict them or program them, but when they come, there is often a sense of, ah, I understand in a way I don't normally my role, my significance, my point in a bigger scheme of things. So those are all the potential kind of benefits of going where the sidewalk ends, right, of going beyond controlled environments and getting into the natural ones themselves. And there's a huge groundswell movement in the last decade or so. There's books that are now advancing the concept of like nature deficit disorder for children. I think it's The Last Child in the Woods might be the name of that book. Poor city-bound Japanese folks in Tokyo and other big Japanese cities are literally organizing bus tours to go to the forests and even engage in tree hugging, which got a lot of justifiably satirical press in America during the 70s and that kind of era here. But now you've got Japanese tourists hugging trees, breathing because they believe it's a positive thing. And funnily enough, they've done, physiological medical studies, and sure enough, it is, increasing immune response, reducing stress factors, et cetera, et cetera. So who'd have thunk it? But that's now a little cottage industry on the other side of the world. So let's now move from the rich environment. Where are we doing these things? And specifically, where are these, action and adventure sports athletes doing these things? To the deep embodiment piece. And what are the three key factors that really make this stuff come alive and let them get into flow more often than most of us? Right? And Stephen just spoke to these, but it's as we kind of conducted the research in preparation for that book, as well as just interviewing, tons and tons of just kind of anecdotal evidence from a lot of pro athletes, these three consistently kind of came up as the sort of nectar of somatic inputs, meaning that these were the ones that people really went for. And it's that, not surprisingly, right, they are unusual sensations. And one of the most easy and unusual is weightlessness. And that can be bouncing on a trampoline. In fact, all of these can be accomplished on a trampoline. But, the bouncing on a trampoline. But if you think about professional sports, right, it's skiing, right? It's boosting air off a mountain or off a cliff. In surfing, it's those huge off-the-lip moments. Even in more organized sports, right, it's the three-pointer at the buzzer. It's the Hail Mary from the end zone. It's those moments, right, where possibilities and outcomes are suspended. And everybody, in fact, even as fans in the stands, right, watching Doug Flutie in Boston College way back, God knows when, which is still kind of, this mythic football play where he hucked one literally end zone to end zone and they caught it, right? For that blissful, whatever it was, 2.6 seconds that the pigskin traveled that 100 yards, right? No one in that entire stadium and no one watching on TV had a different thought. They were just there. Their awareness was in that moment, right? So weightlessness is a phenomenal thing. And as is, it's opposite. What happens when that bird, that flight, that skier, that ball come back to Earth? And what happens when we don't just experience gravity in its usual 1x version, but we experience gravity compressing us, something we resist against? That can be a motorcycle racer laying his bike over in the corner, or again, a ski racer, or a surfer with a huge bottom turn, right? Any and all of those feelings feel, not only do they feel wonderful, it's a compressive force. It actually massages and moves our internal organs, right? It strengthens and refines our spine. It's teaching our brain. We're getting these kick-ass sensory inputs as, where are my hips and where is my inner ear in relationship to my skeletal structure, in relationship to gravitational loading in space? Right, and that's just awesome. And so our brain lights up like a Christmas tree, and then throw in polyaxial rotation, which just means rotation around more than one axis. So gymnasts, back in the day, kind of Olympic standards, that kind of stuff, 10-point judging scores, they were all very linear. I would do a front flip. I would do a side motion. I would do a spin, and it would all be very clean and tight. These days, if you're watching, anything from parkour or free running, which is kind of like urban gymnastics, just kind of running off obstacles and street features, or you're looking at any of the sports, whether, again, surfing, snowboarding, skiing, skateboarding, everybody is sort of playing with tweaking and torquing all of those more conventional kind of XYZ axes and mixing them up. And that, too, provides very rich, very novel sensory motor inputs to our bodies and brains. And when we turn them all on, we literally and actually get smarter. We build new neural networks to be able to hold and process that information. And, an interesting study that kind of upended the dumb jock stereotype was, you know, quick, rapid physical decision making with, you know, college students, half of whom were athletes, half of whom were regular folks, playing kind of a giant game of that video game Frogger, like how do I hop across the road and not get squashed flat? And the athletes did much better, and you would have thought, oh, well, they had faster reaction times, or they could jump quicker or higher or something like that, and that wasn't the case. But what was the case is that they were able to process complex moving environments, aka the highway or their sports field, and they were able to make informed judgments about what to do next in three-dimensional space more efficiently and effectively than the non-athletic counterpart. So literally, you in the use it or lose it category, engaging our bodies and our brains at the same time, or even just engaging our bodies, trains our brains. And the two together are more powerful and effective than one by itself.
Hey, Jamie, before you go to the next slide, I did... One of the greatest lessons I ever learned in using kind of the deep embodiment trigger came from skier Glenn Plake, and back from the one of the early extreme skiers with the big mohawk. Amazing guy, amazing skier. But Glenn taught me that whenever you're going to ski something really steep, gnarly, dangerous, he tried to do an airplane turn into the chute. An airplane turn means bounce off the ground, turn 180 degrees in midair, and then kind of land and go on. It's just an 180 degree turn in midair. But his point was doing that, and that moment of weightlessness at the top of the turn was often enough to pull the flow trigger, so that by the time he actually landed in the really gnarly chute, he was already in flow. It was a way of kicking himself into flow before he actually had to do the dangerous thing that he needed flow to do. Thought it was always a super interesting bit of advice.
Perfect. And so, yeah, and a way to think of this is, you know, would you rather be running dial-up, meaning I'm a brain on a stick and the rest of my body is disembodied, I'm actually not really engaged or paying attention to all of the data that I could be sensing, perceiving, and integrating, or would I rather be on broadband, right, sensing, thinking, feeling, using all of my data feeds, right, and integrating them into a perspective on, right, where am I, what am I doing, and what am I trying to accomplish. So here the idea is just absolutely engage our bodies and we train our brains in a very effective way. All right. So this is one that, you know, if for those of you that have read Rise of Superman or studied flow theory prior, right, the sort of fancy pants names for this is the autotelic nature of the flow state, which just means that it's really fun and self-supporting, sustaining, and meaningful. What we want to talk about here is just fundamentally when we do those things, particularly kind of the zero G, the multi G, the rotations, they are awesome, super fun. And as a result, we are compelled to come back to this stuff and do it again. And we don't need an accountability partner, right? We don't need a coach or any of those things. I don't need to put up a commitment contract to go and ski on a powder day, or to, you know, go and surf beautiful, perfect, glassy waves with no one else on them, right? Those experiences, just like kids going out sledding until they can't feel their fingers and toes, right? I mean, really, just childhood play in general, right, is just a beautiful example of an autotelic or intrinsically motivated experience. And how many of us, particularly as we age into kind of, you know, quote-unquote mature and adult lives and commitments, have too many of these things in our life? Right. Aside from if you're single, kind of going out to the bars on the weekends and seeing if you can come home with someone, because ultimately, you know, one of the more primal drivers still remains in the kind of the romantic realm. But other than that, there's not an awful lot that populates adult lives, excuse me, that really is self-fueling. And if you think about, I mean, the surfers are an easy group to bag on, but, you know, surfers in general are a relatively kind of bohemian and alternative bunch and don't often pay a whole lot of attention to the particulars of life responsibilities and commitments. Now, that's a gross exaggeration and, you know, simplification, but let's just, you know, go with it for a little bit, the classic surf bum. But those guys will be out of bed for dawn patrol, meaning they'll be up in the dark. They will be putting on cold and sandy wetsuits. They'll be paddling out into 50-degree water on a, you know, foggy day. I mean, what on earth is that? That's misery. But they do it because they have been rewarded often enough with the flow state that comes with catching that perfect wave that they're treating. And what's interesting about this is that if we can harness that, if we can harness this intrinsic motivation, right, we have something incredibly compelling to do with our own practice, because most of us fail at practice and fail miserably, right? Even just check your performance. How have you done in this last couple of weeks versus what you thought you were going to do when you signed up for the program, what you said you were going to do as we were finishing a class versus what you actually ended up doing through the week, right? And for most of us, the explanation would be somewhere along the lines of, oh yeah, I wanted to, I thought I was going to, but dot, 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 stuff happened, things got in the way, I got busy, it was hectic, right? I just didn't feel like it, right? I.e. other things trumped it. But the beauty of the intrinsic motivation of a flow state is it drives us. And rather than feeling guilt, I've got to, I really ought to, I haven't, but I should or must, right? Or vanity, I'm doing something to preserve or protect a sense of myself, as thin, as fast, as athletic, as sexy, as whatever it might be, which neither of those is particularly durable or resilient, right? The fact that it's just so awesome, I can't not wait to do it again. If we can find more instances of that in our life, we can fundamentally change how we practice, learn, and develop. And, you know, that just brings us to the last point, which is, you know, and you know, thankfully, Malcolm Gladwell and his popularization of expert performance theory is, you know, is coming under enough appropriate questioning and revisioning at this point. But this idea that spending, you know, 4 to 8 hours a day of your life every day for a decade is the way you get good at things is absolute drudgery and, you know, really pretty grim. And it's probably why most of us aren't, you know, world-class experts at many of those things we love to do. But the idea of being, if flow halves the learning curves, right, and it's really fun, we have the rocket fuel, the motivation, and we also have a shorter route to cover, because when we're in a flow state, we are learning even more effectively than just with mere expert performance alone. Stephen, were you going to add something?
No, Danny, keep going.
Okay. So this one is just, you know, one of those things, but we'll name it and then try and give you guys a relatively neutral and semi-responsible way to think about this, which is it is not an accident that the flow hackers, the best flow hackers in the world, have been in the action and adventure sports community. And they have been on the fringes of mainstream society and social norms. And one of the things that they have, in fact, done from back, you know, in fact, gosh, really back into the 19th century, but for our purposes, we'll go back to at least as far as the 1960s and the establishment of Camp 4 in the Yosemite Valley in California, which kind of became, you know, ground zero for big wall climbing and the progression of that sport. All the way through kind of island culture, North Shore, Hawaii, all of those kind of components, and everywhere in between, that these communities have always skewed away from conventional states of consciousness and substance use. And fundamentally, you've ended up with, you know, folks that are not particularly into Prozac. I mean, fundamentally, you've ended up with masters of self-medication, right? And that's whether I do it via my flow-seeking activities, my adrenaline, my, you know, my exhaustion, all those kind of things, and or a liberal hosting of additional substances. Those guys are there, and they've been kind of on that raggedy fringe, not without consequences and not without derailments of some really talented and gifted folks. But in general, I think it's fair to say that those communities have consistently had additional rooms of their self that they have explored and accessed versus mainstream consensus-driven, socially defined roles. And they and alcohol is actually usually fairly low on the list. And if you look at Colorado, if you look at Washington, if you look at some of these other beautiful natural places with very vibrant outdoor lifestyles, et cetera, you know, it's pretty apparent what they're up to instead, which tend to be non-conventional approaches to pursuing non-ordinary states of being. If we take a look at this, just to kind of put a point on it, and how kind of strangely ambivalent and conflicted, and particularly the United States is, but I would say most of the Western world, is that we are in a situation where, back to when Stephen was first identifying kind of the neurochemicals that are part of a flow state, the ones that our brains actually naturally and perfectly produce, right? So we're talking about norepinephrine, right? And you could say, okay, so that's an internal stimulant, focuses attention, jacks us up, makes us alert and awake, right? And you have all the Adderalls, all the Ritalins, right, which is what we're doing on the chemical side, as well as the methamphetamines, right? So you have that whole category of pharmaceutical and street substances that are stand-ins for that natural neurochemical. You have dopamine, which is, obviously most closely associated with cocaine, but shows up in lots of other, chemical triggers as well that people ingest. You have the endorphins, which show up in the entire opioid family, so everything from morphine to heroin, as well as OxyContin, codeine, and those whole, what do they call it? In fact, they call it, what the joke, I think, is I've heard some law enforcement folks calling, redneck heroin. But you end up with, fundamentally some tragic instances there of people looking to find their way into this space and not figuring it out or pulling it off. And lastly, anandamide, which is, is an endocannabinoid, meaning we internally produce it, but it's got, it shares many chemical correlates and triggers with THC or cannabis. So you figure about that kind of hat trick of five neurochemicals, which our bodies and brains produce seamlessly in an integrated fashion, and then think of all of the, basically accidents, deaths, incarcerations, and just total, wrecked lives that come from us trying to clumsily cobble this stuff together externally. And I think, as of 2011, more Americans die from prescription, not even licit and illicit, just purely prescription drug overdoses alone are killing more Americans than car accidents. So, this notion of it's not just for the bohemian fringe, it's not just for the surf bums and the ski bums, we are all doing it. The question is, are we doing it skillfully and intentionally, or are we doing it, sort of wantonly or destructively? But this is, without a doubt, one of our major, public health crises. And what does it mean instead to say, okay, that's all going on out in the world, the overprescription of young children, all these kind of psychotropic drugs during their neurological and psychological development. We've got all the adults in the public health crisis. We've got all of the, the tragedies that result. What is it like? What would it be like for all of us to realize, wow, we hold the keys to our own kingdoms quite literally? And for a host of both maladies as well as just optimal human living, and that anything from PTSD to ADD, to depression, to social anxiety, right, to, lethargy, obesity, low libidos, you name it. What happens if we just say, hey, we now understand the levers to optimal neurochemistry, aka the building blocks of the flow state, and we now take our responsibility back for our own states of awareness and being, and we use some of this stuff as a blueprint or a roadmap for how to get there for ourselves and others as well. So that brings us at last to the high consequence component, and we'll move through this quite quickly because we want to give you guys as much time as possible for the Flow Triggers worksheet. This is really where you guys get to, choose your own adventure this week and going forward. And again, I mean, this could be, this alone could just be something you spend a year working on playing with. So as I'm discussing the high consequence component, please look on your right-hand chat bar. Please check the sticky note. Well, actually, let's just see. I would believe, hopefully, if we can also post just the link to the Flow Triggers worksheet, that would be awesome. And as I'm describing the high consequence, which was the last leg of our three-legged stool, would also just love your feedback on where do you naturally go? As you've been going through these and thinking deep embodiment, like, whether that's yoga, whether that's wrestling, whether that's, whatever it is, running, gardening, I like to do it by getting out and being in my skin. high consequence, I really do like that rush. I like that thrill. Or rich environment, I'm actually, you know, I love being in. And by the way, rich environment is not exclusively connected to big natural settings. We're using that as a specific example because that's where the action and adventure sports athletes are going. But a rich environment could be a museum. It could be downtown city. It could be any place that you're seeking deliberately or just intuitively that has more than your average novelty and complexity. So go ahead and just check one of those boxes, which is your go-to flow trigger. And then I'm going to go ahead and unpack the high consequence. So one of the first things, and in fact, you know, National Outdoor Leadership School was founded by a guy named Paul Petzold. If any of you are not familiar with that neck of the woods, it's very similar to Outward Bound, and they lead mountaineering, guiding, and leadership courses. And way back in the 60s, he said, hey, you know, the best thing about winter courses, he says, in the winter, feedback is instant, right? And what he meant was, if you're camping and you drop your spoon, boom, it's gone. You don't see it till the springtime. You forget your socks. You don't bring your boots in, right? They're frozen solid. Like, you get very tight learning loops. And as a result, it's very difficult to kid yourself or fudge the results. Because bam, cause effect, as John Lennon famously sung, right? Instant karma is going to get you. So the instant feedback loop of playing in high consequence environments is harsh but fair, and it's fundamentally the laws of physics. And what that does is it allows us to accelerate our learning cycles. We're literally just getting more in faster. It's the equivalent of speed chess versus, you know, chess by mail. And I am learning because I'm getting more rapid iterations. And by the way, that harsh but fair, the fair part is crucial. Because if we think about as we try and learn in the world, let's say you get a performance review at work, but the people reviewing you, you know it's a political catfight. You know that the person sitting next to you is like, you know, throwing you under the bus because they've got their different agenda. You know your boss is an incompetent boob. And here you are having to read, right, all of these deeply human, fallible, not objective in any way bits of feedback for yourself, right, and trying to sort the wheat from the chaff and come up with the tiny nugget that's actually relevant and useful for your own development. Compare that to, you know, this guy on the bike. Ooh, I was 2 miles an hour too slow going off that kicker. I cased the back end of that landing, and now I am eating shit. Ouch. Right? That's very clean. It's not arbitrary. It is not subject to human whims or, you know, a playwright who has to, you know, rely on the New York Times theater critic. Was it, or am I or aren't I a talent, right? You get out in the world, you get out in the physical world, and high consequence environments, instant feedback is beautiful, it's harsh, it's fair, and it's fast. And that forces me to pay attention, and it gives me very accurate data for me to then continue to learn from, okay? The next is peak arousal, and this is where we, you know, where we get the moniker or the stereotype of the adrenaline junkie. And I suppose there are such things, but they don't tend to last long or live long if they really are going big and trying to hang with the big boys. The actual quote-unquote big boys, the true kind of masters and professionals in this field, are the exact opposite of adrenaline junkies. And in fact, what they do is, yes, their heart rates escalate. Yes, it's terrifying to stand on the top of something big and gnarly that can put you in the hospital. But what they do very effectively is find a way to convert that initial peak arousal, that fight or flight adrenalized response, and then get into the relaxation phase en route to flow. And by focusing on breathing, by focusing on visualization, by focusing on whatever it is they do, they may have music blasting in their ears, they've got their own process, they are able to take that energy, and instead of fighting or fleeing, they use it to hop up and turbocharge a more, you know, fundamentally a more fluid response. And that's the other component, which is when you're in a situation that, you know, your body, your brain, some parts of you are telling you this could be it, this could be curtains, right? You tend to cease spending time imagining or rehashing the past or the future. Now, the caution here is what happens if you can't forget? What happens if you took a really bad slam last season or last week or last run And as you're standing at the top, your mind, your mental energy and focus and attention are stuck there. Or they're stressed out by the exciting but terrible possibilities of, okay, either this is the first time I've tried a double backflip, and either I come out cheering and I win the contest, or I'm, you know, in a neck brace. Those two things will destroy somebody if they can't handle it. But the ones who can are the ones who continue to win and stay alive, and they do use that arousal, use that risk and consequence to bring them to a zero-point focus in the future. And again, to the point of, you know, the old mountaineers, bold mountaineers, but there's no old bold mountaineers. I think you could kind of, if you inserted adrenaline junkies for that, you'd get a pretty similar answer, which is that flow hackers don't just seek adrenaline. They actually pay attention to it and try to minimize it, and they try to move through that arousal cycle to get to a more resourceful and considered state in the flow state. And adrenaline junkies themselves may occasionally get lucky and pull stuff off and gain attention or notoriety, but very few of them actually have long and happy careers. And the final one of all is just this notion of real consequence, mortal stakes. In this world that we live in, at least in this, you know, incredibly fortunate chunk of real estate known as North America, we've been pretty well separated from dying, and not just dying in battles and conflicts and those kinds of things, but just dying in general. And if you think about the, you know, the housewives of whatever, fill in the blank, Miami, Atlanta, whomever, and you see those, you know, abominations of plastic surgery gone wrong, and you think, dear God, what is that? What are we doing that there is such a kind of neurotic obsession with youthfulness? And you juxtapose that with, you know, the percentage of our elders, right? I mean, in most traditions, your elders are revered and are seen as the repositories of tribal or cultural wisdom, knowledge, insight. And one of the, you know, multi-billion dollar growth industries in our country right now is nursing home and assisted care and all those other components, where we outsource at, you know, minimum wages, at least to the providers, the care and even nursing and, you know, and overseeing the dying of, right, our elders. So we, you know, I think it's fair to say we are somewhat divorced from some very simple circle of life kind of stuff that, you know, any other human at any other point in time in history have been intimately connected to. And this sense of going out there and actually putting on the line on purpose is a rare and privileged opportunity. And that can sound perverse. It might even sound reckless. And certainly when athletes like Shane McConkie, the skier and base jumper, or fill in the blank, there's lots who have come to untimely ends, the conversation's almost always the same. How could they? That's so selfish. Particularly if they have, you know, spouses, children, and that kind of thing. And the other answer is just, you know, what would be more cowardly, right, is to never live at all. And that brings us to, you know, the last two bullet points, which is, you know, compounding our little sort of societal aversions to aging is also just, you know, over the last century plus, the increasing technologization of combat and warfare, to the point where it's gone from, you know, even the Civil War, right, with the invention of Gatling guns and those kind of things, to World War One with nerve gases and those kind of things. I mean, basically, it's become, you know, it's gone all the way to, you know, Air Force, you know, enlisted guys in a room in an Air Force base in California playing Star Wars with drones, you know, halfway around the country, and then going home and watching American Idol in a suburban neighborhood. You know, we have become, with the exception of special operators, we've become massively distanced from just the cause effect of mano y mano, you know, man versus man, Achilles versus Hector, whatever those kind of showdowns used to be. We've become very divorced, even in the traditions that you would think where, you know, mortality would be still front and center. So that becomes this sense where, but in these communities, in these action and adventure sports communities, you go to funerals that you would really, really rather not go to. There are close friends, there are brothers. You pull people out of the ocean that don't revive. You pull people out of avalanche slide. You strap people on the backboards at the bottom of big rocks. And that lends a gravitas, that lends a seriousness and a consequence that takes it from I'm winning sponsorship dollars, or I did enough flippy, spinny, twisty things to get, you know, a decimal point more than you did. And it puts it more firmly and squarely back in the realm of life, death, and consequence, and why we're here. And so hopefully this is kind of, you know, look at how one community of practice is doing it, gives us some access to and hopefully some inspiration. The biggest thing I want you to know, to hold with you tonight is this, I don't have to do it exactly like this, but how might these categories inform or inspire or suggest the appropriate translation for my life? So the invitation and challenge here is don't just adopt these things. Right, that might be reckless or foolish or both, but adapt them. And if these categories are valid, and we think you know they're useful, what additional thinking or insights will they come up with for me? So let's go ahead and just take a quick look at our poll and see deep embodiment, high consequence, rich environment. And it turned out to be a 50-50 split for you guys on the body side of things. I like to get into flow. Through using my body, and 50% on the high consequence and poor old rich environment. That's so funny because, interestingly, we taught a course in Big Sur at a place called the Esalen Institute, and I would say 60% of the people were on the side of rich environment, and specifically not adrenaline, not like I'm going out there on bikes and skis or climbing or surfing or whatever it was. It was much more, I like going hiking in nature, I garden, I go for walks, I do whatever it is. So it's it just goes to show that this varied band of flow hackers that we are really do come at this from some significantly different places and motivations. So what I'd like to do now is please invite all of you to go ahead and open up your flow triggers worksheet, and we're going to spend the balance of our time drilling into that and giving you guys the opportunity to identify what are your assignments going to be for this week. Okay? So hopefully you guys can see my screen, which should be showing the flow triggers worksheet itself.
Hey, Jamie, let me stop you for a second. Michael, can you repost that note? The Dropbox link is going to a dead link. Thank you. Jamie Beck.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of go through this assessment. And your goal is to both rank where you currently are and then see what you'd like to do next to up the ante. So hopefully you guys should have your flow triggers worksheet 1 open and available, and you should hopefully also be able to see my screen, which is showing it itself. Okay? A couple of quick notes. The examples here are examples. They're just to seed and prompt your thinking. Use them if and only if you can't come up with something better for yourself. And the invitation is challenge by choice, which means, you know, up the ante to the extent that you're comfortable. The more risk you take, the more reward you will get as a general rule of thumb. But on the other hand, don't break things. Start slowly for yourself. Far better to stick with this than to crash and burn with an overly zealous assignment for yourself. Okay? So the first category is we're going to jump into rich environment, just see how we do there. And the first category is radical novelty. So the question is on this one is how much unpredictability or newness do I feel I have in my life right now? Okay? On a 1 to 5 scale. So it could be that you've just broken up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, quit your job and moved to a new town. You might be, 5 on the novelty scale, back to the point of potential stress and discomfort. Or you might have been same job, same life, same wife, right, for 10 years and nothing has changed. You know exactly how every day is. Okay, and that would be a 1 or even a 0, right? So just go give yourself a quick rank on unpredictability and novelty in your life right now. Okay? We then want to ask ourselves, what is the one thing? Clearly there's tons I could do, but what's the one thing I'm going to choose to do this week to increase the amount of positive novelty, right? The Greeks had a word, distress, right, which we all know. They also had the word eustress, which is positive change or challenge. So we're talking about, how do I increase my eustress? And an example would be, again, novelty, brush teeth or do anything with my non-dominant hand, right? Again, that crosses the midline, that fires up new neural networks, it challenges myself, and I have to pay attention. That's very easy. Medium, why don't I consider doing something fun? I could go bungee jumping, I could go indoor skydiving. There's more and more of these kind of recreational, experiential activities, but do something I've never done before on those realms and get different sensory motor inputs. Or spicy, right? Could I go and book an adventure trip? Zozy.com has all kinds of cool stuff curated actually by some of our, you know, friends and even advisory board members who are professional athletes and photographers and those kinds of things, and they go to incredible places. What would it be like for me to say, hey, no more Walter Mittying it for me, right? I'm actually going to go out and do something, and I'm going to commit. It doesn't have to be that you do it this week, but it could be that I've researched it, I've made a commitment, I've picked a date window, I've even identified a course or something, right? Mm-hmm. The next one, big nature. So quick assessment, how much connection to the natural world do I feel I have in my life right now? Okay, you could live on a lake, you could paddle to work, you might be off the charts. Connection to the natural world is so good on you, right? Or you could live in concrete and steel and spend as little time as possible, especially here in hot summers, right, in anything other than air-conditioned indoor environments. So just check, how much connection to the natural world do you have right now? What's the one thing you can do this week to increase my exposure to nature? And we could say, hey, I could just go outside and eat lunch or walk each day. That might be, or, and this is a great one, honestly, if you want to just the simplest, cheapest way to improve quality of life, would just be watch the sunrise and set each day. It's really basic, shows up in a lot of contemplative traditions, monastic traditions, et cetera. It's so kind of simple and obvious, but gorgeous, right? There is nothing quite like it. As far as just resetting our clocks. And by the way, you are getting vitamin D, you're getting ultraviolet, you are absolutely calibrating your circadian rhythms and inner clock. So it's not just kind of a passive aesthetic thing, you're actually doing things to body, brain, and nervous system that are positive. All right, medium, right? Well, you know, we've all got access to, I mean, it's great, it's varying degrees, right? Some of us who live in New Mexico or Colorado or the coast of California can have off-the-charts exposure to natural beauty. If we live in Kansas or New Jersey, right, it may feel harder, but it's not impossible. And just figure out where your best natural park or place is and at within an hour of home. And what would it be like to just spend a half day there with no agenda, right? And then the spicy version, what happens if you take that further? And what happens if you're actually pushing it to spend a night out? Right, and it could even be, as if you know, depending on your comfort levels, what happens if I go with, you know, this is depending on your comfort level. Just spending a night outside camping could be plenty for you, right? Or you could say, oh, I do that quite often, or I did that a lot when I was a kid or in the scouts or whatever, and I need to up the ante. Great. So consider without a shelter. Consider with minimal food and clothing. Consider fasting. Right, consider whatever you'd like to that's relevant for you, but consider that. That was obviously one of the easiest go-to places for flow state seeking in indigenous cultures, right? We have access to it just as much as we choose. Okay? And the last one in that category is simplified self. So here's the question is, how much simple being versus the having and the doing do I feel I have in my life right now? And on the one hand, that's a slightly nebulous question, but on the other hand, you know, just kind of inquire into it. How much time do I have without an agenda, without a checklist, without an inner monologue, right? Not always just moving to the next thing. And what's the one thing I can do this week to increase the amount of unselfconscious being? So mild, turn off Facebook for a week. Turn off your TV as well, any other social media streams you're on. Just turn it off, take a fast. Medium, right? Show up differently someplace. right? We were guest speakers at an event that Red Bull put on last year on human potential and performance. And their invitations was, you know, handing out sort of Mardi Gras masks at the entrance to a bar. And everybody had to wear them for the evening, and no one could talk about what they did for a living, right? So that alone was disruptive and was uncomfortable and sometimes dull and irritating. And, you know, you get the whole gamut of emotions. But it also, you know, absolute certainty created a different conversation and a different experience because we were all playing that game. So consider that. Show up and be someone different. If you're normally incredibly well-dressed, right? Nice watches, nice shoes, nice handbags, whatever those signifiers are of culture and status, you know, slum it and see if you're treated as the same person, right? Or vice versa, right? And then Spicy, we just had, this was sort of said jokingly, but it's also potentially a serious game. Try arguing naked. So that on a bumper sticker at an event a couple of months ago, and had to laugh because you think, wow, okay, what am I doing when I'm arguing? I'm usually projecting, right, righteousness and certainty, right, all both of which are infinitely harder to do when I'm with that person, but I mean, presumably someone you're pretty close to, and I'm actually truly, you know, both literally and metaphorically naked or vulnerable. So consider those things. Play with them. Okay? So hopefully you should now have three Likert ratings or 1 to 5 scales on novelty, nature, and self. And you should ideally have placeholders. You can always come back and change or improve, but placeholders for each of those categories. What are you going to do this week? Let's move on to deep embodiment. And let's take a look at embodied cognition. So the first one is how much multisensory stimulation and learning am I getting right now? And that's anything other than the brain on a stick. Passive content and consumption, screen time, reading, talking, listening, right? All of that being kind of classic cognitive learning, which our culture currently, you know, massively privileges. Okay? So rate that on a 1 to 5 scale. Ask yourself the one thing this week to increase my amount of non-cognitive learning. So mild. Take a functional fitness class. That could be a TRX, which is kind of those ladders and suspension things. You could take a CrossFit class. You could take a yoga or a Pilates class, really just anything. And if you're already active in that space, as it looked like 50% of you were in your deep embodiment check-in, do a different one. Do the exact, do the one you think you hate. If you're a Pilates fanatic, go and do CrossFit. If you're a CrossFit, you know, big box roid head, bar, go do Pilates. Right? Mix it up. Actually train, you know, the whole muscle confusion thing of P90X. Go confuse your brain. Forget your muscles. Okay? Or do a fine motor skill. Right? Knitting, crocheting, ceramics. Right? Any of those kind of components. Juggling. Right? Medium, take a trapeze or trampoline class. Absolutely awesome, but also gives high degrees of perceived risk, but safety. Right, and the other was a sensory deprivation tank, which interestingly are making quite a comeback these days, both to the likes of Joe Rogan and his podcast, but and also interestingly at the higher levels of the government. So the notion of floating in a completely black saline solution or buoyant solution, so you don't have to do any doggy paddle or treading water, can be an amazingly helpful thing, particularly in our days of digital overload. Just getting a nervous system reset in darkness and silence can be profound. And if you don't happen to have sensory deprivation tanks, if you're a city that's, say, smaller than 1 million people, you may not. But you can absolutely put something together with your own hot tub and or a bathtub. So consider that as something that would be fun. Sort of going the opposite direction of overstimulating, you're now explicitly trying to understimulate to then set up, you know, basically a reset and contrast. On the hedonic engineering front, so how many states of consciousness are you reliably accessing right now? Okay, and it could just be, I don't even know what you mean. I come home, I veg, I mean, but think about it, we all do it. We're always all constantly trying to alter our states of consciousness from less preferable to more preferable. So if we're at work and we're busy and we're stressed, we come home, what might I do? Well, I might alter it with food. I might grab a bunch of salty, fatty, sweet things. I might alter it with alcohol, right? Sit on the couch and pop a beer. I might alter it with fundamentally a self-induced vegetative state where I'm sitting on a couch recumbent, banging my beer and my salty, sweet, and fat food sources and watching hours of television, because what I'm trying to do is just not be thinking about my day anymore, right? I would say that's a pretty low grade, not helpful or creative way to alter my state of consciousness, but by God, I'm doing it, and I'm doing it consistently. So ask yourself, how often and how many states do I have access to? So holotropic breathwork would be a mild one, which is simply nothing more complicated than very deep inhales and exhales, about 25 to 30% faster than my normal breathing rate. And you can Google it online, but do not underestimate it. You can actually have some quite powerful experiences, and the chemistry behind it is you're fundamentally giving yourself mild nitrogen narcosis by changing the pH of your blood via your respiration, which is a sort of mild version of what divers get when they ascend too rapidly, called the bends. But check it out. That is it's deceptively simple, but also powerful at the same time. And if you want to listen to music that is evocative in some way, we have a link there on your form. You can feel free to check that out, or anything else that is specifically generally no lyrics, some form of repetitive or deep quality of sound and complexity and rhythm, and check it out. The medium, do the Art of Flow video, which we have, with a heart rate variability monitor, right? So we talked about the app that you guys have access to. Eat 4 ounces of dark chocolate. You need at least that much. 2 espresso shots, and if this is in your world, life, and preferences, consider, you know, some very distilled vodka. And you have 2 shots of vodka, which is an ethanol-based, right? Obviously, the alcohol is a depressant. The 2 espresso shots counter that with the caffeine as a stimulant. So you're actually going to experiment. I mean, this is no different than the Red Bull and vodka ideas that, you know, spring breakers do. But you've also thrown in the dark chocolate, right, which is giving you flavonoids and endorphin releases and other kind of subtle shifts there. And then you're doing cardiac coherence and some sort of meditation state. And the spicy one, well, on this front, folks, that's up to you, and that is fully a challenge by choice. So continuing down our list, intrinsic motivation. The idea here is, how much am I feeling? Are there parts of my life where I am spontaneous and joyful, where I do this thing because I love it? And some of us, if we're lucky, it could be a week, you know, a Wednesday night softball game, or it could be, you know, whatever it is. There could be some things you just look forward to. They're like beacons in your life, right? Great. How do we get more of them? Why have one and the rest of it is gray clouds, right? So mild, right? Pick your birthday meal, the thing that was a kid you were, if you had that kind of a tradition in your house, right? What is your absolute go-to favorite meal ever, right? And share it. But don't wait for your birthday. Don't wait for the special occasion that typically happens. Do it right now. And actually put real attention into creating it and harnessing your passion and enthusiasm for it. Medium. Come home and do absolutely nothing that you typically do, including cleaning, including bills, including watching stuff, including whatever it is, answering emails for tomorrow. Bag it all. And then see what it is you want to do. And pay attention on a daily basis. If you conduct this for a week, right, you will probably experience a full sine wave of you know, motivation and dereliction and then inspiration that comes first from just decompressing, then what do I want to do? I don't want to do anything. I'm a total waste of space. And then something emerging, which is actually maybe my true motivation. Okay? And then on the spicy level, high-value activity, right, which you wanted to do more than you have actually gotten done, and then commit to it. But here's the point. Rather than this being a guilt story, right, I should, I couldn't, I'm lazy, I'm worthless, I'm good, I'm bad, whatever this, you know, the back and forth is, that hasn't worked, we know that, because otherwise you'd be doing it, connect the completion of that act with something awesome as an indulgence. And that could be food, that could be videos, that could be, you pick it. But you do the task, you get the treat, and just connect the two there. And there's been some fascinating research on that. That's not just kind of an abstract experiment. Okay. Last one, and we just want to bang through these quite quickly because we're getting close to the end of our time, which is the high consequence realm. Now, obviously, by definition, be careful in this realm. It's high consequence. So that said, how can I increase instant feedback in my life? How can I tighten up the feedback loops? An annual performance review is not really telling me how I'm doing at work, right? Till death do us part is not really telling me if my spouse is on fire, alive, and in love, right? So how can I, right, figure out a little bit more quickly what I'm actually up to and the cause-effect loops of my choices? Rescue Time is a great little app. It tells me exactly how I spend my time online. I think I'm working. I think I've been working for 5 hours. Actually, Rescue Time will tell you that for 2 hours and 45 minutes of that, you were on YouTube, Facebook, and eBay, right? So just check it out, Rescue Time. Don't do anything else. Don't change anything else. Just get the feedback. Medium, publicly post your goals, right, and check in daily with a done or not done. So here's what I'm doing. Public accountability. This is what I say I'm going to do, and I do it or I don't do it, and I follow up by just telling you that. No explanations, just did it, done or not done. What effect does that have on me? Spicy, and this is an awesome one, and a lot of folks in our prior class took this one up. So super, you know, opportunity if you choose to. Ask a close person, you know, someone close to you each day, what's the one big thing you'd want me to know about myself to help me take my life to the next level? And listen. And then politely, the key point, tactfully, and why haven't you been able to tell me that before? If you do that one, guarantee you will be looking, thinking, and feeling differently. Your heart will race. You will have all of the feelings of high consequence and probably some damn good intelligence, and you'll probably be closer to a number of people that you care about that you've just been beside lately but not necessarily as connected to. Okay, and keep in mind, you could blow things up and get totally sideways, but that's why it's called high consequence. Peak arousal. Check this one out. What's the one thing you can do to increase your ability to shift out, right, of the fight, flight, freeze? Okay, so mild would be practice box breathing, which is just I take 5 seconds in, I hold it. I exhale for 5 seconds, I hold it. I inhale for 5 seconds, I hold it. For 5 seconds, right? That's the box. It's 5 seconds on a side. And that alone, that's one that's used by Navy SEAL teams. And you can go again, Google that. There's videos. There's all kinds of things. But just consider practicing that and see what you can do to downregulate your normal hypoxic response of, I'm panicking and I don't have enough to breathe. We do. Okay? The spicy one, go and do something that terrifies you, right? Sign up for Toastmasters. Public speaking is the classic fear everyone has. So go do it. But do it today. Don't hear about other people doing it. Bungee jump. But if you're going to do it, don't just bungee jump once and have it done with. Do it 3 times in a row so that by the second and the third times, part of you is almost bored. Part of you is almost saying, bring it, even though the rest of you is still terrified. Right? Get to that place where you start normalizing what had been extreme for you. Okay? And the final one, mortal stakes. How well, and this is the translation from the action and adventure sports world, right, to our, you know, humble mortal lives. What is my relationship to dying and death? Okay? And rate that. How well integrated am I feeling about that? Versus today is a good day to die. Right? And then add that. You can watch Into the Void or Miracle in the Andes. Both of those. Miracle in the Andes is a book. Into the Void is a great film on a crazy-ass climbing disaster down in South America. Available streaming on Netflix, so it's easy to get to. Just consider those. Those are both pretty profound testaments. Miracle in the Andes is about the Uruguayan rugby team that crashed in the Andes and ended up having to, you know, eat their dead comrades and find their way out. So pretty burly, but also ultimately a very inspiring story. Medium, you know, consider getting in touch with either an aging relative or volunteering in a nursing home or you know, some other elder care space. Those will be, guarantee you, uncomfortable and transformative experiences if that's not already a part of your world. And the spicy, right, is write your own obituary. And what have you lived? How have you lived so far? How close are you to all those goals? Right? So that brings us to the conclusion of our worksheet and our course for today. What I'd love to be able to do is now just return to our assignment, so that we're all clear on what to do next. And this gets us to here, which is please post your Flow Trigger action plan on Flow Hacker Nation. So it's been great to see everyone's contributions. Love to see more. That's the number one way we can connect with you guys and answer questions and sort of really ground this in your own experience. Please go ahead and continue to pay attention to your sleeping, right? And continue to ideally get more of it, right? That's the simplest and easiest, but if you also want to be tracking it with the app, go ahead and continue to practice your sort of essentially dynamic or active attention training by the Autoflow video with the heart rate variability, okay? And then go do, pick three, so one from each category. Your goal, it could be the mild one, could be the medium one, could be the spicy one, but pick one deep embodiment, one rich environment, one high consequence act for this week. So just three things to do, right? And go do them this week and write back to us from that time. So that brings us to the end. Stephen, want to be able to give you an opportunity for any closing thoughts as we wrap here, and then we will look forward to seeing you guys post what you're up to for your flow triggers for the coming week.
Yeah, the only thing I want to leave you with is have a lot of fun with this exercise. We've, in previous classes, this exercise has really proven to be deeply, deeply transformative for people and a lot of fun, and you seem to gain a level of self-knowledge along the way that's really, really useful going forward. So have fun with it, and please post about your experiences on the Facebook page so we can see what's going on and get in touch with you.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Stephen. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Go forth, create kick-ass experiments, and go and conduct them. Report back, and we will see you back here next week. Cheers, everybody.